American Sunday Business and Oil Sections, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the oil report of the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Saturday, May 8th. Teaching ESG. PPDC offering course on ESG fundamentals applications. The story was written by Mella McEwen. Rapidly growing interest among the investment community and the public in ESG, environment, social, and governance, has energy companies scrambling to both understand the concerns and implement related initiatives. That has prompted Midland College's Petroleum Professional Development Center to schedule a course on ESG fundamentals and applications. The two-day course will be held June 8th and 9th at the PPDC at 105 West Illinois Avenue in downtown Midland. Presenters Pat Lepowski and Bob Peterson, both with Envision Group, will lead the course, offering best practices on evolving ESG criteria and reporting requirements. Lepowski, founder and chief executive officer of Envision, has worked with energy companies, including Baker Hughes, Encana, Halliburton, Precision Drilling, and Schlumberger. Other clients have included airlines, industry associations, pharmaceuticals, and technology companies. Peterson serves as a senior partner and is heavily involved with strategy and strategy implementation. He currently coaches four energy technology startup companies. He formerly was a founding partner of Schlumberger Business Consulting and headed ExxonMobil's technical services and the merger integration team. EnLink Midstream unveils emissions reduction plans. The story was written by Mella McEwen. Companies across the energy spectrum continue to announce their plans to reduce, if not mitigate, emissions from their operations. ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP, Royal Dutch Shell, even Midland-based Diamondback Energy have unveiled their plans. EnLink Midstream, which can process more than a billion cubic feet of natural gas in just its Permian Basin operations alone, has become the latest to announce its plans to achieve net zero emissions and issue a sustainability report for 2020. The company, which has an office in the Bank of America building in downtown Midland, plans to reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, executing emissions reduction strategies between now and 2050 as it moves toward that goal. That includes reducing methane emissions intensity 30% by 2024 as compared to 2020 levels and pursuing a path to reach a 30% reduction in total carbon dioxide emissions intensity by 2030 as compared to 2020 levels. To further illustrate its commitment, EnLink has joined other producing companies and midstream companies in the Environmental Partnership, a coalition committed to pursuing emissions reductions. Quote, "It's clear that an energy transition is underway as the world moves to less carbon-intensive energy production," Ben Lamb, EnLink's Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer, told a reporter telegram by email. Quote, "Still, we believe that oil and gas will continue to be necessary to power our lives and economy for decades to come. EnLink is primed to be a key player in this transition, as around 90% of EnLink's business is focused on natural gas and NGLs, which emit less carbon than other natural resources and are important bridge fuels as we move forward in the transition," end quote. The announcement of the net zero emissions by 2050 is a step toward the company being an even more active participant in that transition, he continued. Across its operations, Lamb said the company has worked to improve its emissions performance and operational efficiencies. Those steps include replacing flares with thermal oxidizers, installing vapor recovery units and exhaust catalysts, and utilizing leak detection technology with optical gas imaging. Other efforts to reduce its environmental footprint include monitoring energy consumption and evaluating ways to optimize energy usage. The company utilizes processes that let it repurpose exhaust heat, a byproduct of operations, for warming purposes required elsewhere. Solar capabilities power methanol pumps, meter stations, and line operating data gathering stations. From 2019 to 2020, the company's total greenhouse gas emissions intensity decreased as calculated by total greenhouse gas emissions intensity per billion British thermal units. Lamb said gas operations and liquids operations, both of which have a presence in the Permian Basin, saw decreasing total greenhouse gas emissions intensity during that time. Lamb said sustainability goals are leadership-driven and a company-wide responsibility. The company rewards employees for achievement of key metrics tied to strategic initiatives like emissions reductions through its 2021 short-term incentive program. While safety has long been a part of the program, he said, this year it has changed to safety and sustainability. EnLink has also developed the reportable environmental incident rate to better measure its environmental performance, making it part of the safety and sustainability scorecard. Quote, "We officially began a sustainability program in 2018 and have evolved it since to where it is today, an important part of our company-wide, leadership-driven, and board-approved strategic plan," Lamb said. "We have heard from numerous stakeholders, from investors, employees, customers, and community members, that sustainability is important to them, and they value the steps we have taken to become more sustainable. We believe that our net zero emissions commitment further positions EnLink among industry leaders in sustainability and moves us one step closer to our vision of becoming the future of midstream." JCAM Catalyst, triple size of oil field chemicals lab. The story was written by Mella McEwen. Heading to Gardendale on State Highway 158, located alongside other oil field facilities, is JCAM Catalyst, an oil field chemicals manufacturer and service provider. Quote, "We started construction 3 weeks before COVID hit," observed Justin Disney, director of laboratory and R&D service with the company. Despite the challenges of the last year, he said expanding the facility was the right long-term decision for the company. Guiding a tour of the company's new 7,000-square-foot laboratory, more than double the size of the earlier laboratory. The lab quietly opened last fall amid a second wave of the coronavirus. Disney said its size makes it unique among other laboratories situated in the Permian Basin. While the company has labs in all the major producing basins, Disney said the Permian Basin remains a big focus for a JCAM analyst. The lab employs 5 chemists, including 2 master-level chemists, and 14 laboratory technicians, with an opening for another technician. Disney estimated the new building itself cost $2.5 million and houses another $5 million in equipment. He pointed to ICPs used in water analysis that heats water samples to 4,000 degrees and allows the lab staff to identify the elements in the water in 5 to 10 minutes. A cold finger apparatus can chill crude samples and identify how much paraffin is found in the sample. The lab can also analyze equipment failure, he said, showing off a piece of tubing that had filled with scale. Scale is a big concern, given produced water can be 3 times as salty as seawater, he said. The goal is to provide operators with answers as quickly as possible, he said, providing analyses as quickly as the same day or the next day. And having the equipment as close to customers as possible was also important, he said. Quote, the closer the equipment is, the easier it is to solve problems, he explained. The lab addresses the lifespan of a well, from drilling to hydraulic fracturing and completion to production to the pipelines, according to Disney. Challenges related to production have increased in recent years as the rise in horizontal drilling has led to unique challenges and an approach to solving the problems, he said. As horizontal laterals get longer and longer and different lifting technologies are used, he said more unique solutions are required to address production issues. A new challenge operators face is that pipelines have stricter requirements on the quality of the oil being moved through the pipelines. Tests that had not been done in the past are now being enforced, he said. He pointed specifically to sulfur and the need to identify the types of sulfur found in crude oil and whether or not they meet pipeline specifications. Identifying the types of sulfur allows for a better treatment, he pointed out. For saltwater disposal wells, knowing what types of solids are contained in the water can prevent them from plugging up the formation holding the water. Water analysis is one of the most common tasks for the lab, with Disney estimating between 5,000 and 8,000 water analyses are carried out by the lab monthly. Providing solutions and not just gathering data is important, Disney said. The lab develops its own chemicals and tests them on issues from scale to corrosion to paraffin. Quote, before we treat a well, we have to validate it's the right chemistry in the right concentration, he said. While the company was impacted by the pandemic like everyone else, he said the lab remained open and the company held on to its staff. Now business is starting to recover, he said. Quote, we've noticed customers are becoming more discerning, relying on analyses to make more informed decisions rather than relying on blanket recommendations, he said. There's more reliance on testing to validate performance, end quote.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, May 11th, 2021. This article is entitled, Oilfield Service Companies Add Hundreds More Jobs, by Paul Takahashi, Houston Chronicle. Employment in the U.S. oilfield services and equipment sector rose by an estimated 1,352 jobs in April, as oil and gas companies brought more rigs online to meet crude demand recovering from the pandemic. The monthly jobs report, published by the Energy Workforce and Technology Council, an industry trade group, estimates that 102,000 jobs were lost during the pandemic last year, representing annual wages of about $15 billion. Since then, the sector has added more than 19,000 jobs, but employment in the sector is still 10.5% below pre-pandemic levels. The oilfield services sector has been among the industry's hardest hit during the pandemic, which slashed demand for oil and products such as gasoline and jet fuel. Many exploration and production companies which hire oilfield services firms stopped drilling new wells and halted production from existing wells for several months last year. The sector shed nearly 27,300 jobs in April 2020, the largest one-month total since at least 2013, when crude prices fell into negative territory for the first time. Oilfield sector employment has grown 2.9% so far this year, as the rollout of coronavirus vaccines has lifted local economies, boosting demand for gasoline and jet fuel. U.S. drillers have added more than 200 rigs since the number of operating rigs fell to a low of 244 in August, according to oilfield services firm Baker Hughes. The council cautioned, however, that its April jobs report is based on preliminary data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is subject to routine revisions. Revised figures for March reduced the number of jobs added to 18,000 from 23,000 jobs. In total, oilfield services companies have restored about 28,000 positions, reducing the pandemic-related job cuts to 74,000 jobs and more than $8.4 billion in annual wages. There are more than 600,000 employees in the oilfield services and equipment sector nationally, including more than 314,000 in Texas.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Sunday, May 9th, 2021, Section A. Do We Really Want to Change America? By Dennis Elam, Associate Professor at Texas A&M San Antonio and a 1966 graduate of Andrews High School. Quote from Crypto Investors Chase Next Hot Coin. A more than 12,000% rally this year in Dogecoin, a cryptocurrency that was set up as a joke and serves no purpose, sending its price to a record 69 cents per token this week. In 1929, economist Irving Fisher said, stocks have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. 3 days later, the stock market took a dramatic dive and the Great Depression eventually followed. The cryptomania is just the latest phase of chasing investments with little or no value. During Holland's tulip mania, one chap organized a fundraiser for a firm whose purpose would be announced at a later date. The same thing is happening with the SPAC craze today. These are shell companies which promise to eventually wisely invest the money which has been raised. While near everyone expects the U.S. economy to boom coming out of COVID, there are signs this might not be the case. After 4 months of job growth, today's report is that a mere 266,000 jobs were created last month, and unemployment ticked up from 6 to 6.1%. While Team Biden's cash from helicopters promises economic expansion, it also diminishes the necessity of going back to work. And chip shortages have idled manufacturing plants. Meanwhile, demand for gasoline is up as everyone ventures outdoors again. Crude oil is priced in the mid-60s. The energy ETF XLE posts a new high at $52.96. Even offshore driller rig has climbed from about a buck to $3.74. For the time being, the oil patch is out of trouble. But did America really vote for an entire remake of America? Or simply put, do you prefer the French model? Consider one of many promises from Team Biden, Free Community College, CC. The CC concept is a wonderful thing. A low-cost, open-door education provides everything from bookkeeping to cake decorating. Typically, a locally elected board chooses a president who works with the community to best provide opportunity. Well, we don't know the details, but should the federal government seize control of CCs, look no further than the FCC or FAA for the model to follow. Control will completely shift to Washington. The local president will be one in name only. Imagine the new paperwork reporting burden. Local control will evaporate overnight. If you doubt me, try to schedule a hearing with the FCC about your local radio or TV station. Team Biden will decide how much you can keep, corporation, or individual as the fruits of your labor. New taxes are being rammed through with a razor-thin congressional majority. America has long prided itself on the American, not the French, dream for individual liberty. Do you really want to ditch a successful 233-year model republic? The Economist. Let It Roar, by M. Ray Perryman, head of the Perryman Group and a distinguished professor at the International Institute for Advanced Studies. In a few speeches and scribblings of late, I have noted that we appear on the cusp of a new roaring 20s, similar to that emerging a century ago in the wake of the Spanish flu, hopefully without any expectation that I will master the Charleston. That modest projection inevitably raises the question, if we roar like the 1920s, will we then fall through the floor like the Great Depression of the 1930s? The answer is quite simple. No. During the 1930s, we had neither the knowledge nor the infrastructure for an effective monetary response. At the onset, the Federal Reserve was less than 20 years old with no mandate to support economic growth until 1948. The tools that it routinely uses are largely the product of research in the ensuing decades. We now have a most competent monetary authority with proven capacity to jump into the breach. Similarly, we didn't understand how to use fiscal policy in the early stages of the Depression. Economists generally clung to Cambridge tradition of Alfred Marshall, whose textbook from the early 1890s still dominated, which held that markets would solve any economic problem if left alone. Some outstanding scholarship in the 1930s taught us that, although among the most powerful and useless concepts ever conceived, markets are not perfect. At times, they must be helped along. At others, they must be constrained. With those realizations, the era of proactive fiscal policy was born. Despite the New Deal's aura and its importance to our social fabric cannot be overemphasized, it was not remotely grand enough to stem the calamity of the 1930s. That took the much greater stimulus that accompanied World War II. We have since learned the value of a well-timed fiscal surge, as is apparent at this crucial juncture of the pandemic recovery. In addition to those major advances in our understanding, there are many other elements in place now that were not around then, including, among others, financial market safeguards and circuit breakers, deposit insurance, more stable currency systems, and retirement security. We are also now a more advanced economy with countless technological breakthroughs to inform and enhance our efforts. I am not suggesting that we know everything, or even that we will apply existing knowledge perfectly. There remains much to learn, and undoubtedly our response to anything that arises will be less than optimal. It always is. I certainly feel comfortable in saying, however, that we have sufficient tools and deployed them well enough over almost a century of subsequent crises to avoid another Great Depression. If necessary, we will do so again. Simply stated, then is not now, and now is not then. Let it roar. Stay safe. Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Sunday, May 2nd, 2021. The Economist. Working Women, by M. Ray Perryman, head of the Perryman Group and a distinguished professor at the International Institute for Advanced Studies. Although the pandemic has spared no one, it has had a disproportionate impact on working women. Over the past year, females have been more likely to leave the workforce due to job losses or conflicts with the added responsibilities surrounding childcare and household sustainability. As the economy recovers, these valuable members of the workforce will be essential. The latest census numbers make that abundantly clear. Moreover, for many, working is indispensable for financial stability. From February to April 2020, employment for women aged 20 and over fell by 12.2 million, a 17% decrease. Over the same period, female unemployment increased by 8.6 million, and 3.8 million left the labor force altogether. Since then, the situation has improved somewhat, but there remain 3.7 million, 5.1%, fewer women employed as of March 2021 than at the pre-pandemic peak. In addition, women, specifically mothers with school-aged children, have been slower to re-enter the workforce. Current projections from numerous sources estimate that female employment might not fully recover until 2024, a full 2 years after their male counterparts. One critical issue is childcare. About one-third of working women in 2019 had children under 18, and pandemic-induced disruptions caused some to decide they could not or did not wish to continue. Even for many who had options for remote employment, the additional responsibilities of assisting with remote education have been substantial. Affordable childcare, already lacking prior to the pandemic and much worse in its wake, would help women return to work, as will reaching the point with vaccines and therapeutics that schools can fully open across the nation. The continuing trend for flexible work arrangements will be beneficial, but challenges remain. There are legitimate concerns that staying out of the office could not only place an additional burden on professional women, but also reduce their prospects for advancement. Evidence suggests that males are more likely to opt to work in the office, interact with management, and maintain visibility. For our economy and society, there is clear value to work-life balance, irrespective of gender. For women, these boundaries can be particularly difficult to navigate for a variety of systemic reasons. Facilitating the return of women to the workforce in a complex post-pandemic environment will be difficult. Initiatives such as improved, affordable, and accessible child care and innovative office situations are essential elements of the solution. With the lowest population growth rate since the 1930s, with counting occurring prior to the effects of COVID, and shortages already appearing in many industries and areas, the long-term need for an abundant workforce is obvious. Maintaining viable options for women will improve growth and productivity and, more importantly, enhance the lives of countless women, children, families, and communities. Stay safe.
Thank you for joining us for this week's readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American Sunday Business and Oil sections. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org. Welcome to this week's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American Sunday Lifestyle sections, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Cindy reading Life and Times from the Odessa American for Sunday, May 9th. Master Gardeners, Attractive Blue-Green Plant Stands Out by Debbie Rowland and Emmy Olmschneider, Master Gardeners. Gopher plant, Euphorbia rigida, is an import from the Mediterranean and Southwest Asia. Its Latin name tells us a bit about its heritage. King Juba II of Numidia, later Mauritania, named the plant after his Greek physician, Euphorbus. Centuries later, Carl Linnaeus assigned the name Euphorbia to the entire genus of spurge plants. Rigida refers to the upright stems of this plant. It is an attractive blue-green plant with narrow, sharp leaves. It produces clusters of yellow flower bracts at the end of each branch in spring. As the season progresses, the blooms turn a greenish tan. This plant is an easy accent to xeric landscapes and are easy to grow. In its native area, it is thought of as a weed. If you are interested in a native alternative for our area, chocolate daisy and Engelmann daisy may be your choices. For color, try golden poppy or brown-eyed Susan. The birds and pollinators will thank you for these. After the blooms are spent, the main stems die and new ones appear from the center of the plant. The old stems must be completely pruned out. This plant grows 2 feet tall and 3 feet wide and requires full sun to partial shade. All soils work for this plant as long as it is well drained. Given these conditions, it is a moderate to fast grower and is hardy to 0 degrees. Gopher plants are